not just the stock market this morning, but it's also the deadly heat wave that has people worried today. Triple-digit temperatures still scorching wide areas of the country.
Welcome to the Climate Change Roadshow with Kelly Tudhope, speaking on despair and empowerment. As part of a whirlwind tour of the west coast of North America, Kelly spoke on August 15, 2007, at the Planetarium in Vancouver, Canada.
And now Kelly Tudhope from Australia and New Zealand.
So as Fred kindly pointed out, apparently I've got an accent and I've never heard it, but please let me know if you have trouble understanding me and I'll slow down or try and enunciate a bit better. Am I doing all right so far?
Yeah.
Okay. So Fred kindly introduced me and gave my background. I've been doing this presentation since the beginning of the year when I was inspired to do so when I saw John Seed speak close to where I live in a place called Ballingen. And he asked whether or not there's anyone in the audience that was willing to get on their feet and spread the message further. And so that's how I came to do this. This is about my 25th presentation to date, and I've just finished the Northern Queensland leg of this tour, which involved about 10 presentations in 8 days. From here, this presentation goes through Washington State to Oregon, California, and then to Hawaii until I return home on the 14th of September. To date, this presentation has been given well over 100 times in Australia, including northern New South Wales, the Sunshine Coast, Sydney, Melbourne, northern Queensland, and down the east coast of America by John Seed just recently, who did 36 presentations in 40 days, which is a bit more than I was keen to take on, but well done to John. So, obviously, I'm not a climatologist. I come here... While I've got a social science background and a background in law, my reason for doing so is really brought about by my belief in a philosophy of a man called Aldo Leopold. And what he teaches is that all of us are plain members and citizens of the biotic community. And so that's what I'm here. I stand before you as a plain, concerned and pregnant member of the biotic community who's concerned not just for my own and my new family's welfare, but for every person here and future generations and every species on this planet. So I'm no expert on climate change, but we've got at least one expert on our team at the Rainforest Information Centre, and his name is Ross Galspan. And I don't know if you know of Ross Galspan, but Ross is a journalist who has been reporting for many of the major newspapers in the US and most recently the Boston Globe, for which he most recently won the Pulitzer Prize for his investigative journalism. Ross says that he came to the issue of climate change not as an environmentalist. He didn't even like trees, he merely tolerated them. But what brought Ross to act on this issue was that he learnt more than 10 years ago that companies like ExxonMobil and other oil companies had been paying scientists under the table to muddy the waters on climate change and make it appear that there was more scientific controversy over the existence of global warming than there actually was. A recent scientific review of scientific literature showed that out of the 950 randomly chosen scientific peer-reviewed documents, that exactly zero of those articles cast any doubt as to whether or not climate change was actually happening. A review for the same time period of major newspaper articles of what they were saying found that over 50% of the articles included some climate scepticism in them. And so this indicates the success of those oil companies. And as a result, it has cost us as a species and both in states and communities and countries 10 very important years in our ability to engage in effective and sustainable action with regards to climate change. So Ross Galspan, in an address called Boiling Point, and he actually has written a book called Boiling Point, has something to say on climate change that I'm going to share with you now.
unintentionally, we have set in motion massive systems of the planet with huge amounts of inertia that have kept this Earth hospitable for 10,000 years. We have heated the deep oceans. We have loosed a wave of violent weather. We've altered the timing of the seasons. We're living on an increasingly narrow margin of stability, and the evidence is all around us. From my perspective, the climate crisis clusters together three dimensions: its natural dimension, its energy dimension, and its economic dimension. Its natural dimension is truly of cosmic proportion. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere traps in heat. For 10,000 years, we had the same amount, 280 parts per million, until about 150 years ago when the world began to industrialize. That 280 is now up to 379. That is a level this planet has not experienced for at least 420,000 years. Unchecked, that will double later in this century to 560, and that correlates with an increase in the average global temperature of 3 to 10 degrees. And for context, the last ice age was only 5 to 9 degrees colder than our current climate. Each year, we're putting about 7 billion tons of carbon into an atmosphere whose upper extent is about 10 miles overhead. Its second dimension, which is its energy dimension, is really staggering to contemplate. Basically, to allow the climate to restabilize requires nothing less than rewiring the entire globe and replacing every oil-burning furnace, every coal-burning generating plant, every gasoline-burning car with climate-friendly and renewable energy sources. The U.S. spends more than $20 billion a year subsidizing coal and oil. The industrial countries spend about $200 billion a year doing that. We're saying that in the industrial countries, take those subsidies away from fossil fuels, put them behind renewables. The oil companies will follow the subsidies and become aggressive developers of fuel cells and solar panels and windmills. As one Argentine climate negotiator said, we are all in the same boat, and there's no way half the boat is going to sink.
So I'd just like to update a couple of those facts, because that was filmed a couple of years ago now. So the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is now at a level that has not been seen in 650,000 years. And for your information, in Australia, our subsidies of the fossil fuel industry are between the figure of $6.5 billion and $9 billion a year. And so it's significant. I think at the worldwide level, it's in the subsidization of fossil fuels is in the region of $350 billion. You know, and some people might say, why are we subsidizing ourselves, our own destruction? It seems pretty silly, I think. So, as Andrea mentioned, probably the person that's done the most to bring about public awareness on the issue of global warming is Al Gore. And he's been going around for the last 30 years raising public awareness, and he started off with a slideshow presentation that became a PowerPoint presentation that became an Inconvenient Truth. And I'm guessing, have most people here seen an Inconvenient Truth?
Yes.
Yes? Yes? And so if you haven't seen it on DVD, I do recommend that you get the DVD out, because there's a really good section in the special features where Al Gore did an update for 12 months later and goes into things like population growth that weren't covered in the original movie. So Al Gore came to Australia last year. His primary reason was to train climate messengers, and he said that although the issue of climate change is rising to prominence everywhere in the world, nowhere more so than in Australia. And many of us laughed because we thought he was just being a typical politician and he was trying to butter us up. But then we started looking around at the facts, and we discovered that an opinion poll taken recently after that interview said that 93% of Australians were concerned about climate change. And we started wondering when the last time 93% of Australians agreed about anything, but I don't know if it's the same here in Vancouver. So Al Gore came and he trained 85 climate messengers in Australia last year, and 1,700 people applied for those positions, which shows that people actually really want to get engaged in this issue. In fact, so many people in Australia want to get involved that now Al Gore's coming back in September to train about another 120 or so people to give his a local version of An Inconvenient Truth. It's not surprising that people are really concerned in Australia, because I'm not sure if anybody here has been to Australia recently, but it's pretty evident that our climate's changing. We are in the worst drought, I think, that Australia's probably seen in memory. In Brisbane, we've got really, really draconian water restrictions to the likes of that you wouldn't even think of. And so in Australia, in Brisbane, you can read on the council's website that the only way that you can wash your car is to use the dew that forms there in the morning. And so this is how little water we have in Australia. Not all of it's in drought, of course. I've chosen to live in a place that isn't in drought, but certainly most of the country is. Even our food is becoming, the food production is becoming questionable. In the Murray-Darling Basin, which is one of Australia's main food-producing regions, there has been serious concerns about the ability of to meet water irrigation requirements, and there was some concern at the beginning of the year that they would actually cut irrigation requirements totally. Our Prime Minister, John Howard's response to this was that Australians should pray for rain. The Rainforest Information Centre thinks that there's some other things that we can do other than pray for rain, even though I'm not dismissing the importance of prayer. And so what this presentation is about is not so much whether or not climate change exists. I take that as a given fact. I think we're now at the point that we can move beyond questioning whether or not the science behind climate change is sound or not. I think that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the number of scientists involved and the credibility due to its peer-reviewed nature establishes beyond doubt that we are experiencing climate change, and now we need to look at solutions. So this presentation primarily looks at why and what stops us from effectively challenging the status quo and from moving into a sustainable future and adopting technologies and solutions that will help us get there. When Al Gore was in Australia, he was interviewed by Denton on ABC TV, and I'd like to share with you what he said.
To me, this is so compelling. I think it's the challenge of our lifetimes, and our lifetimes represent the period when the human species will make fateful decisions that will determine the future of human civilization. Now, as to the paralyzing effect of seeing these consequences, that's a real danger. And there are people who go, as I say in the movie, from denial to despair without pausing on the intermediate step. And what denial and despair have in common is they both let you off the hook. You don't have to do anything. And actually, the mature approach is that all of us have to take, we have to find our way to it, is to act to solve this. And we can solve it. Despair is completely unjustified. I continued to advocate bold changes, but ran into that brick wall of resistance. And one of the lessons I learned was the need to go to the grassroots level. I don't know if you have that phrase here. And to go to people one by one, community by community, and engage in a fairly massive and sustained effort to try to change the minds of people about this crisis.
So I think Al Gore's done a really, really fantastic job, and I have no qualms about what he's done. He's just brought this issue really into the public eye. Especially in the last year, I think the amount of awareness on this issue has risen maybe beyond what people originally thought was possible in such a short period of time. But nonetheless, I'm going to humbly disagree with a few things that Al Gore just said. And the first thing I'm going to disagree with is the way that he characterises despair. He says that we have everything that we need to solve this crisis, and therefore despair is completely unjustified. I agree. I think that we do actually have everything we need to solve this crisis. I think that we are an extremely intelligent species that can rise to this occasion if we so choose. But I don't think it actually follows that we are going to do what needs to be done. You know, 93% of Australians say they are concerned about climate change, but no one or very few people are actually doing anything about it. And Neither is our government. Our government is probably doing less than those 93% of citizens that are concerned about climate change. It's doing very little at all to bring about changes, and we only hear two things come from our government's lips, and that is carbon sequestration, which I believe is not actually such a big technological option in Vancouver, but it is in Australia, and nuclear. So rather than look at all of the options that we could have in Australia, the government is focusing on these two only, regardless of all the issues and the problems associated with these technologies. I also think that despair in this situation is completely justified. If we look around, we come to see that we are in the sixth mass extinction period ever to face life on Earth in the 4,500 million years that life has existed here. It's only happened five times before in the whole life of this planet, or whole period of life on this planet. Scientists tell us that last year 30,000 species became extinct, and that this year 30,000 more species are going to become extinct. And this is going to continue unless we really adopt meaningful solutions to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. Predictions say that if the temperature increases above this magical number of 2 degrees, then we are in serious problem. We have a serious problem. 2 degrees is known as a tipping point, whereby after which we get runaway climate change that is taken out of the hands of humanity to curb. We've already experienced a 3/4 degree rise across the globe, degree Celsius rise across the globe in our temperature, and we are set for a further 3/4 degree rise by the emissions or the greenhouse gases that are already in the atmosphere due to the lag period between which the emissions are released and the greenhouse gas effect. And so we actually don't have very much to play with. So once again, I think that this makes despair completely justified. But the reason I think that Al Gore says that despair is completely unjustified is because of the way that he sees despair. You know, coming from a Western culture, we are taught that every one of our negative emotions is something to suppress and to hold down, because the last thing we want to do is to express them. And so despair and other negative emotions like anger and fear has become seen like as a dead end. And once we get there and experience these feelings, oh woe is me, and all is lost because there's no way out. And it becomes a quagmire and an excuse for non-action. You know, but there's another way to see despair, luckily, and this is what deep ecology, which is the framework that John Seed has developed with a lady called Joanna Macy over the years. And it teaches that we can move through our feelings of fear or anguish or despair, into a position of empowerment, and that if we can sit with these feelings and move through them, then underneath them is the golden nugget or the golden seed or the silver lining in the cloud that we need to find to move into a position of empowerment. And indeed, the only thing that we really need to do to move into this position of empowerment and passion is to release these emotions by expressing them with people that are invited to honestly discuss them. And so I'd like just give you an analogy. Like, you have a bottle of fizzy drinks and you can shake it up, and it's like these emotions. The emotions are like the fizz in the drink. And every time that we learn more and more about our environment and climate change, species loss, pollution, it's like the bottle continues to be... We continue to shake the bottle and this pressure builds up. And the last thing we want to do is to release those emotions from the bottle. And so we use a lot of energy to keep that cork in the bottle, because the last thing that we want to do is to release them. This energy that we use to hold down that cork in the bottle is part of the energy that we can use to find the passion and the motivation that we need to bring about effective action and on this issue of climate change. You know, when we have these feelings of hopelessness and despair, and we can come to think that, oh, well, you know, all is lost, that it's all hopeless, and, you know, I'm only one person and the issue is so big that what can I do? And, you know, it sort of lets us off the hook. And when we have these feelings, that we sort of feel quite justified and sort of all right because we've been let off the hook. But we need to move beneath these feelings to find this empowerment. And so what usually happens when we do these presentations is that a workshop follows it around. And this despair and empowerment workshop invites people that participate in the presentation to actually come and experience the truth of what we're saying, or like what I'm saying here tonight. And unfortunately, it hasn't happened in Vancouver just because of how my schedule has worked out. But if people are interested in actually experiencing this, and I do recommend it's a fantastic opportunity to get to know your own feelings and also to get to experience the truth of how other people feel. You know, we can feel quite isolated and in our emotions towards the environment, and a lot of people don't really talk to each other. You can go out to a party or something and people will say, you know, how are you today? And, oh yeah, all is good. It's certainly not the right answer to say, oh well, I'm really in despair because 30,000 species died last year. And so we've got this conditioning about how to respond, and so if we can overcome this and express our feelings in a room full of people, then it's an amazing experience that brings the empowerment that we need to act on this issue. You know, our ancestors, especially our pre-human ancestors, made intelligent enough decisions that every single one of our ancestors reached an age of reproduction before they were consumed. And they did this before they grew this big bulge over their head that helped them to make logical decisions. And I think what we actually need to tap into our feeling function in order to find this passion and this motivation to act on this issue. You can just think of two examples. When you're on the edge of a cliff, the thing that stops you from stepping over the edge of the cliff is the fear that you're going to fall. Or when you're looking at a shark in the water, the reason that you don't pat that shark is because of the fear that it might eat you. And so these feelings that we have are really intelligent if we choose to listen to them. And I think that if we did choose to listen to them in the past, that we probably wouldn't be in the situation that we are now in. So I'd like to invite people here to begin to experience the truth of what I just said, and feel free to bow out of this if you want. It only takes, what, a minute or so, but I'd just like to invite people here to like turn to your neighbours and just to say whether or not you think what I say is true, or whether or not you've had any of these feelings that I'm talking about, and I'd like you to do that now. So everybody, I find that when we do this exercise, everybody gets really excited, and we usually have a wombat, a dancing wombat that I usually show you, but he's having a little sleep at the moment, so I'm just going to carry on, and he'll be back in a minute. So the wombat's going to tell you about something really, really important, and well, actually, first off, it could be a beaver, but there's a bit of controversy over whether he's a wombat or a beaver, and you'll see why. So what the wombat slash beaver wants to talk to you about is the importance of recognising the interconnectedness of all forms of life. And this is really, really fundamental to any solutions that we adopt with regards to climate change. And it's said that if any solution that we adopt is to be meaningful and lasting, then it has to be accompanied by a complementary value system. You know, what we're taught in our Western society, and many of you may not even be aware of this, but what we're taught is that life is fragmented, that it is sort of like dots that aren't actually related to each other, and so these dots aren't connected. And that also that our life, every form of life by human beings, has no value in and of itself, and that it's only valuable because humans give it value. These are two, this is known as instrumentalism or materialism and reductionism. And these are two fundamental philosophical beliefs of our Western society that it is said must change. And we need to change, I believe, to one of a value structure that is holistic, that sees that life is interconnected and valuable. And, you know, the experience that you just shared with each other really shows the truth of the interconnectedness of life, because if we weren't all part of this earth, then there's no right way that we'd feel despair for the creatures on the earth. And so when we can actually find the courage that we need to experience our feelings of despair or hopelessness or fear, then what we can actually do is move beyond them and find that the reason that we feel despair is because it actually is a reflection of our compassion for all forms of life, and that we feel this compassion because in truth we are interconnected. And so I think if we can consider this and see the truth in it, then we will definitely take the steps we need to heal this world. And the beaver's back, so I'll let him finish what I was going to say.
Yo, listen up. This is your home. It's the only one you got. This place is pretty, but you can't live there. You can't even get there. So I repeat, this is your home. It's the only one you got. Cherish it, protect it. It's the only one you're going to get. These guys, they're your neighbors. They ain't going away. They ain't leaving. You have to get along with them. So you have to learn to share. You have to get along. You have to learn to get along. Because they are your neighbors. They're not going away. Okay, all this stuff, the animals, the waters, the sky, the ground, the bugs, the fish, the tacos, the people, they're all connected. Everything is connected. They all depend on one another. If you ignore that, you're doomed. Repeat, doomed, okay? So listen up. It's all one. Not two worlds, not three, one. Just one. So get it in gear. Remember, all is one, okay? Hit it!
I thought you'd like him. He's pretty good. So the wombat actually comes free. You can take him home. He's downloadable from that site just up there. So if you want a take home version, just write down that and you can download him for free. So I'd like to talk a bit about solutions, about what we can do to bring about the necessary changes in our life and our lifestyles to combat this really serious issue of climate change. I'd like to start by saying that I don't actually think that any person knows what the solution is at the moment. I think that there are lots of potential solutions, but they're sort of like pieces of the jigsaw puzzle that we don't quite know how to fit together. And so I think that we really need to look into it individually and collectively to decide what is the best route and methods to take. I don't think there's one solution. I think there's many solutions, and we just need to work out into what quantities and what mix we want to make that happen. So I mentioned before that in Australia there's two solutions, or so-called solutions, that we hear from our government's lips, and they are nuclear and clean coal, carbon sequestration. I don't actually think that either of these solutions or either of these technologies are solutions at all to the issue of climate change. I think that they are solutions to the political and industrial problem of how to keep business as usual running in the face of a public that is increasingly concerned about climate change. I don't think so. That's what I think those solutions are for. You know, in the last 12 months in the USA, the amount of people that have said that they think that climate change is the number one environmental issue facing the world has doubled, and it's going to continue to double as awareness is raised. So politicians and industrialists have a serious problem on their hands, and so this is why we hear solutions like that. I believe in Canada, nuclear is not an issue. No? It is an issue, so it's not as clear cut. They haven't thrown that out. Okay, so well, I'll talk briefly on nuclear then. You know, it's touted as this clean green technology, and that the electricity is produced, electricity produced by nuclear does not produce carbon dioxide. And yeah, okay, that's true, but you need to look at how the electricity is made, and then you find out that it's not this clean green technology. an average-sized nuclear power plant emits between 376,000 tonnes and 1.2 million tonnes of carbon dioxide a year. This amount will go up as the quality of the uranium declines, and given that there's only between 50 to 100 years of uranium in the world, it's the sustainability of nuclear as a power generation option is seriously questionable. In Australia, and I believe here in Canada, one of the other solutions that we commonly hear by our governments is this is changing our light bulbs. Is this correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know how long you guys have got to change your light bulbs, but in Australia we've got 2 to 3 years to change all our incandescent bulbs to these new fluorescent varieties. And
mercury.
Oh, yeah. There's an issue with mercury, which is toxic waste, so you can't throw them away for sure. So, but the government didn't tell you about that. But in Australia, they also didn't tell you that what the amount of electricity that you're going to save is pretty small. In fact, it's only 0.14% of electricity generated, and that saving is going to be gobbled up in 14 days at predicted electricity growth rates. And so it's sort of really insignificant, and from the point of view of reducing our carbon emissions, I think it's good because it helps, when people do this, it helps bring our integrity and our intention to do something in line with our actions. But in and of itself, I don't think changing its light bulbs is going to do much. And I find it really interesting that there's a joke to this effect. Do you guys know this joke? How many people does it take to change a light bulb? Anyway. So the other thing that we hear is... as a potential solution is biodiesel or biofuel. And the Dutch government got a head start on the rest of the world 10 years ago and said that its diesel had to contain 10% of palm oil in its composition to reduce emissions. And it looked like this really good idea, but as demand increased, so did the environmental degradation associated with the growth of the palm oil industry. In Borneo, it is especially problematic because the forests, the swamp forests, are clear felled to make way for these palm oil plantations. And swamp forests hold like 30 times... Oh, no, hang on. Swamp forests hold a lot more carbon in them than do normal forests because of the way that they decompose when the trees die. When they decompose, the trees actually turn to peat. And so when they clear fell and burn those forests, not only do they release the carbon that's contained in the trees, but they also release the carbon that's in the peat soil. In its whole lifetime, a palm oil plantation will never ever sequester the amount of carbon dioxide that is released into the atmosphere through that process. And so it's a very, very serious problem that we're facing. In a study by Friends of the Earth, I believe, showed that between the years of 1985 and 2000, 87% of deforestation in Malaysia was a direct result of palm oil plantations. Unfortunately, the USA is about to engage in a similar operation in the Amazon by creating sugar plantations to produce ethanol, and so there's another risk on that front. So it's not just about palm oil, it's also about these so-called sustainable crops, which also threaten food security because there's now competition between crops to produce food and crops to produce oil, which is something we really need to think about when we adopt changes in our fuel production methods. So I think that we're in a bit of a dangerous situation because a lot of people and a lot of industrialists are going around grasping at solutions and solutions that aren't actually thought through about their economic and their social and their environmental costs. And I think because of this, every person that is capable really needs to start looking at the issue and at the solutions about what they can do. But one thing is for sure is that the solutions that to solve our climate crisis will not come from government, and they will not come from industrialists. There is only one place that they can come from, and it is with the people, and it starts right here with the people in this room and everywhere else. I also don't think that the solution should come from anywhere else. I think that this problem is so big and has such far-reaching consequences that everybody that is of moral capacity actually needs to look at the solution and to think, what can I do and what should I do in this circumstance? I don't think we should leave it to a handful of often invested interests to come to the determination of where our planet should go and where our species on this planet should go and if they should survive or not. I think it's up to us. So a lot of people think that in order to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions means that we've got to go back into the Stone Age, and people don't want to do that, so, you know, that's another way to get off the hook. But, you know, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit, and I'm just going to tell you about a couple of things that we can eat, I guess. And the first thing is that in the United States, and I'm sure this probably correlates to Canada as well, is that if the speed limit was reduced from 70 to 50 miles an hour, it would save 1 billion barrels of oil a year, which is actually roughly what the US imports from the Middle East. So you can do the math on that one. In Australia, that correlates to about 89 Ks. You can slow down. It's a little bit dangerous to do that yourselves. This is not just an individual action. You know, people get quite angry if you slow down and hold them up. So to bring about this sort of change would require a collective action. And it also requires the relevant knowledge, because can you imagine what it would be like if somebody ran for parliament that said, if you vote me in, I'm going to reduce the speed limit by 20 miles an hour. They'd have absolutely no hope of getting in. And so we need to have the education as well on this issue. Pat opened tonight with a discussion on rainforests, and temperate rainforests in particular, and it really leads to a very important point. What we need to really do on this issue is to stop illegal logging and also diebacks of forests. In Australia, we've come up with an initiative to help with logging, and it's called the Global Initiative on Forest and Climate, and the Australian government is giving $200 million to this fund to monitor forest cover, to show where people are illegally logging, and part of that fund is going to the Indonesians to stop or help them to control illegal logging. At the same time, it is prepared to allow for Tasmania's old-growth forest to be logged, and so there's a little bit of inconsistency with what it's preaching and what it's practicing. But it's really key to make sure that we can limit and limit. Actually, we need to stop clear felling forests, because forests contribute to 25% of the carbon dioxide emitted into the atmosphere. And so if we can do that, we're going to take big steps towards combating climate change. So there's lots of things that we can do as individuals, and I'm sure many of you here are beginning to be aware of what you can do at the individual level, yeah? Yes? Yeah? One of the biggest things that we can do is to look at what we eat. And what I'm about to say as an offer is for your information, and so I'm not telling you what to eat, because people get a little bit upset when I do that. So I'd just like to say that if you chose to eat locally produced food, and I believe there's a couple of farmers markets in Vancouver, yeah? So if you eat locally produced food, then you certainly reduce your food miles. And it's about the average piece of food moves about 1,600 miles between where it's produced and where it's consumed. So if we can do that and choose locally produced food, then we certainly will reduce our carbon footprint. The other thing that we can do is reduce the amount of meat that we eat. In Australia, and I know it's significantly less here in Canada, but in Australia, the amount of methane and agricultural gases released equates to 18% of our greenhouse gas emissions, and that's actually higher than stationary energy and transport in Australia. So we can really do a lot if we can stop methane from cows and sheep being emitted. And we can only do this if individuals choose to reduce or stop consuming meat and dairy products. The other really big way that we can reduce our emissions is by eating organically. And obviously this is one of my areas of interest given my 7-year activism in genetic engineering. But you see, there was a study produced in the United States that showed that if 320 farms of 10,000 acres each in the United States converted to organic, then, get this figure right, 1 million, it'll be equivalent to 1,174,000 cars being taken off the road. And so that's really, really significant. So I know that organic costs or can cost a bit more, but the more demand goes up, then the cost will certainly come down. So Al Gore was in the United Kingdom a while back, and he did an interview with Channel 4 there, and I'd like to share what he said, because in typical political fashion, he managed to say the same thing no matter what question was asked. And I'm not going to share the whole 40 minutes, but I've just got a couple of minutes here tonight.
To me, this is so compelling. I think it's the challenge of our lifetimes. And our lifetimes represent the period when the human species will make fateful decisions that will determine the future of human civilization. Now, as to the paralyzing effect of seeing these consequences, that's a real danger. And there are people who go, as I say in the movie, from denial to despair without pausing on the intermediate step. And what denial and despair have in common, what makes the climate crisis so dangerous, is that it could literally end civilization. No matter who was president, no matter who was prime minister, if the Congress was the same or the parliament the same, if the people did not feel this sense of urgency, then the changes would not be made. And I don't think anyone can do what really needs to be done unless and until there is a sea change in the way the public feels about this issue. In my country, one of our founders, James Madison, wrote that the most important bulwark of a democracy is a well-informed citizenry. And the way citizens have been informed on this question has left a lot to be desired. When they are truly confronted with the facts, with the scientific consensus about what we're facing, then they will, I am confident, rightly demand of the politicians in all parties that they start offering really meaningful solutions to the crisis. Go see the movie, read the book, inform yourself in other ways, go to the website, and try to learn as much as you can about the fact that this is by far the most serious crisis civilization has ever faced. It is a genuine planetary emergency. The normal rules of politics should be set aside. When we have an emergency, we respond and do things that we would not otherwise think possible. The maximum that is considered politically feasible today is still short of the minimum that will solve the crisis. And what that means, very clearly and very simply, is that we have to change the minds of the people in the United States and elsewhere in the world. And we have to put the truth before them in a clear and persuasive and undeniable way so that the people, being informed of the truth of our situation, will then demand of the politicians and in the process give them the permissions they need to have some courage to make the dramatic changes that will solve the crisis. But we don't have much time, and it's on our watch. And the only way in a democracy to get the dramatic changes considered by the leaders, whoever they might be, is for the people to really be seized of the crisis and to demand action.
And so the only time that I can see in the history of humanity that we've risen up to an occasion is with Pearl Harbor. And so if I say that the day after Pearl Harbor everything changed, I think you know what I mean, you know. General Motors changed from producing cars to producing tanks in, I think, about 6 weeks. And so what this shows is that we can make the necessary changes very, very fast if we need to, but we just have to have the political will and the public will to do so. We have to realise, the world has to come to realise that it is in the same position as the United States was with regards to Pearl Harbor, many years ago, but the difference now is that people don't actually know the extent of the problem or even realise the fact that global warming is happening right now. It's not happening 50 years in the future. In Australia, the sea level has already risen by 70 millimetres. we're already experiencing drought, and I'm sure we're already experiencing dieback in Canadian forests. And so I think people really need to understand that we need to act now, because it's not something that's far off in the future. As Al Gore said, the only way that we can do this, the only way we can bring about the political change, is for a massive grassroots movement to arise. And so this is primarily the goal of this RIC roadshow, is to go about and to establish climate action groups. Over 100 of these groups have already been established in Australia and in the US, and ultimately it is our goal to network those groups into a big umbrella group and to really bring about a grassroots movement, probably of the likes that the world has never seen, and of course in conjunction with as many groups as are interested. And so what we are suggesting is two things. We're giving away two CDs, and I'll show you them. We've got one by Ross Galtspan and John Seed on climate change, despair and empowerment, that John Seed and Ross Galtspan did a few years ago. And so we're giving this away and suggesting that people have like Tupperware parties, but climate change style, and get together with their friends and their family and start learning about the issue of climate change, and start, I mean, you could like write letters to politicians at the end of those little climate change Tupperware parties if you like. We've also got another one called Boiling Point, which is the full video of Ross Galtspan, a segment of which you saw earlier. The other thing that we are seeking to do is, as I mentioned before, establish a grassroots network, and I'd like to invite people here to start doing that. And so if I was to ask if people here were interested in beginning a conversation, an ongoing conversation about what they would like to do and what they'd see in their communities, would people here be interested? Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, woohoo! So I'm going to like pass a sheet around and invite you people to sign up. I'd just like to mention that it's actually two-sided, and so we're minimising paper. So to conclude, I'd like to show you one more segment, one more DVD, of a lady called Vandana Shiva, who's a pretty prominent activist in the area of genetic engineering and the patenting of seeds in India, and she's here speaking on global warming. After that, I'd like to invite everybody here to start that conversation and introduce yourself to your neighbours and really just have a chat on climate change. You can ask me questions, but be warned, I'm not a climatologist, as I mentioned at the beginning of the evening, so I may or may not be able to answer your questions. But the chances are, with the amount of people here, that someone here will be able to. So the important thing is really to start this conversation. And so we'll show you Vandana Shiva first.
And we are in a situation where we are literally preparing to wipe out the capacity of our species to survive on this planet. The planet will carry on. It'll adjust. It'll regulate itself in new patterns. The planet will carry on regardless. But the conditions that human beings need for survival, we are changing that so dramatically that I think our generation is going to see within its lifetime conditions become so severe for living. Not because people don't have enough incomes, but because the ecological burden of a false growth model is catching up with us. And I believe now's the time for every sane person to go beyond this insanity and join hands to just have one project, maintaining the conditions of human survival on this planet. And that's the ecological challenge.
Actually, I'd like to invite Fred back up if you want to talk about Communities for Climate Action. And so this, I'll let him tell you all about it in a bit more detail than he did earlier, but with people's permission, I'd like to circulate that list that's going along to this already established group. And so rather than fragment the community, we start to mesh the community together and to bring about more effective action. So I'll hand you over to Fred.
Make a few comments, and then Kelly, shall we have people talk with one another, and then we'll have discussion questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Before we go further, I would like us to express our appreciation to Kelly for coming here.
You have been listening to the Climate Change, Despair and Empowerment Roadshow with Kelly Tudhope, a graduate in law and social science. This recording from the Planetarium in Vancouver, Canada, on August 15, 2007, was made by Radio EcoShock. Find more free green audio from their website at ecoshocklikeanelectricshock.org. Get all the details about the Climate Change Roadshow at www.climate.net.au. That's climate.net.au.